A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel wrote in with something that's been turning over in my head since I read it. He's asking about how we form a self-image, and how much of what we think we know about ourselves is actually someone else's voice that we've mistaken for our own. Specifically, he's talking about people who grew up in toxic homes with narcissistic parents. Parents who spent years telling them they were bad at certain things, incompetent at certain things. And as children, they internalize that without question, because what else would a child do? Then adulthood arrives, and the counter-evidence starts trickling in. Other people tell them they're actually good at the thing. Their own experience tells them they're good at the thing. And sometimes, the pattern is almost comical. They turn out to be exceptional at the exact thing they were told their whole lives they could never do. Daniel's question is about how you form an accurate self-image after that, how you figure out what your actual capabilities are, what your actual affinities are, separate from what was installed in you. And he's asking whether the process can be accelerated, because life is short, and every person who contributes at their fullest potential contributes to the whole human project. His phrase was something like, every human has a unique potential that, when realized, contributes their own unique light to the human firmament. So the question underneath the question is, whose construction is your self-image, and can you renovate it?
The renovation metaphor is exactly right, because what we're talking about isn't a blank slate that got written on once. It's a structure that was built early, by someone else, and then you've been living in it so long you think it's original architecture.
And the original architect may have had a vested interest in you believing certain rooms were unusable.
Right. So let's start with the mechanism, because there's a specific term for this, and it's been around in psychodynamic theory for a long time. It's called the introject. The introject is what happens when a child takes in the parent's voice, the parent's judgments, the parent's model of who the child is, and installs it as their own internal voice. Not as something the parent said once, but as a fundamental truth about the self. The key distinction is between remembering that your father called you lazy and believing that you're lazy. The introject is the second thing.
So it's the difference between a quote and a premise.
That's good. A quote you can attribute. A premise you just live inside. And the reason this happens so completely in childhood is that children don't have the cognitive equipment to evaluate a parent's judgment as opinion rather than fact. A child's survival depends on trusting the parent's model of reality. If the parent says the stove is hot, the child doesn't run an independent verification. If the parent says you're bad at math, the child receives that in the same channel. It's not, my father has an opinion about my mathematical ability, it's, I'm bad at math. The parent's model is the child's reality. There's no gap between them yet.
And with a narcissistic parent, there's an extra layer, because the assignment isn't even based on observation. The parent needs the child to fill a role in the parent's own narrative. So the child becomes the incompetent one, or the difficult one, or the one who can't hold a job. And the child's actual traits are irrelevant to the assignment. The parent isn't describing what they see. They're casting a pot.
The narcissistic parent's need to maintain their own grandiosity means the child gets scripted into a supporting role. And here's the thing. The child doesn't know they're being cast. They think they're being described. So if the parent needs the child to be the one who's bad with people, the child will be told that, and the child will believe it, regardless of whether the child is actually socially gifted. The assignment comes first. The evidence gets arranged around it afterward.
And that explains why the counter-evidence later in life is so hard to accept. The assignment is already load-bearing. It's holding up a whole story about who you are and what your childhood meant.
Let me bring in the clinical work here, because there's a specific framework that maps directly onto what Daniel's asking about. Robert Firestone, who developed what's called voice therapy, made a clinical observation that I think is the most important detail in this whole conversation. When patients articulate their critical inner voice, the voice speaks in the second person. It says, you're worthless, you're going to fail, you're not smart enough. It doesn't say, I'm worthless, it says, you are. and that grammatical detail, that the voice addresses you rather than speaks as you, is evidence that it's not actually integrated into the self. It's running as a foreign process. It's a recording, not a live thought.
So the voice that feels most intimate, most internal, is grammatically external. It's addressing you from outside, even though it's inside your head.
That's the paradox. The thing that feels like your deepest self-truth is actually the least you. It's a parent's voice, or a composite of parental voices that got installed so early and so completely that it never had to identify itself. It just sounds like reality. Firestone's clinical observation was that patients could articulate this voice as a distinct entity, a commentator that runs alongside their actual experience and narrates it in real time. You're messing this up. They're going to find out you don't know what you're doing. You should just quit now. And the voice has its own syntax, its own emotional tone. It's not just low self-esteem, it's a separate cognitive system.
That distinction matters because the generic advice, just think positive, repeat affirmations, doesn't work on a foreign process. You can't shout down a recording by being louder than it.
Right. And that's the misconception I want to flag early. The internalized critical voice isn't low self-esteem. Low self-esteem is a diffuse feeling of not being good enough. The introject is a specific voice with specific content, specific claims, specific predictions. It says you're bad at this particular thing, and it says it in a particular tone, and it has a history. That's why generic self-affirmation doesn't touch it. The voice isn't a mood, it's a program.
And programs don't respond to encouragement. They respond to being reclassified.
We'll get to that. But first, let's sit with the paradox Daniel named, because it's the most counterintuitive part of this whole thing. Why do people so often end up being very good at the exact thing they were told they were bad at? You'd think the message would become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Told you're bad at math, you avoid math, you never develop the skill, you stay bad at math. And that does happen. But the other path is at least as common. Told you're bad at math, and something in you rebels, and you overinvest in math as a form of proof-seeking. You don't just learn math. You need to be excellent at math, because excellence is the only thing that would refute the voice. Mediocrity wouldn't do it. You have to be so good at the thing that the original claim becomes absurd.
So the overcompensation isn't random. It's aimed directly at the specific content of the criticism. The voice says you're bad at this, so the person builds an entire identity around being good at this. The criticism becomes the blueprint for the ambition.
And the person who is told their whole childhood they're not a people person and grows up to be a therapist or a negotiator isn't just succeeding in spite of the message. They're succeeding because of it. The message created a hypervigilance toward that domain. They paid more attention to social dynamics than they ever would have if no one had told them they were bad at them. They studied the thing they were told they couldn't do because the stakes of being wrong about it felt existential.
Which means the parent accidentally trained the child in the exact skill they were trying to deny them. The narcissist creates their own refutation.
There's a grim elegance to it. But here's where the trouble comes in, and this is the counter-evidence problem Daniel's really circling. The person who was told they're bad with people, who becomes a brilliant negotiator, still doesn't believe it. The evidence is all there. They've got the career, the results, the colleagues who tell them they're good at it, but the evidence is processed as an exception rather than a refutation. I did well on that project, but it was a fluke. I got that promotion, but they'll figure out eventually that I don't deserve it. The introject has a privileged position in the self-narrative. It gets to veto any incoming data that contradicts it.
It's an asymmetry. Positive feedback gets filtered through the negative introject and discounted. Negative feedback gets amplified because it confirms what the voice already said. One critical comment can undo 10 compliments, because the 10 compliments were never really believed in the first place. They were logged as anomalies. The one criticism was logged as confirmation.
And this is exactly what the predictive model research points to. The brain isn't a passive recorder of evidence, it's a prediction engine. It builds a model of reality and then filters incoming data through that model. When the model says you're bad at something and you do well at it, the model doesn't automatically update. It tags the event as noise. To actually update the model, you need sustained, repeated counter-evidence, not one success, a pattern of successes. And even then, the update is slow because the old model has years of reinforcement behind it.
So, the person who's trying to form an accurate self-image isn't just collecting data points. They're fighting a filtering system that was designed to protect the original model. The model has tenure.
That's the phrase. The Interject has tenure, and the tenure was granted in childhood, when there was no review process. So now we get to the harder question, the one Daniel is really asking. If the voice is a foreign process, and the counter-evidence is being filtered out, what actually works? How do you expel it, or at least stop it from running the show?
And I think the first step, from everything you've laid out, isn't to silence the voice. It's to reclassify it. Move it from the category of self-truth to the category of inherited artifact. This isn't me. This is something that was installed in me. The voice doesn't have to stop talking. It just has to stop being believed.
That's the core of Firestone's voice therapy, actually. The clinical practice involves having patients articulate the critical inner voice out loud in the second person exactly as it speaks internally. You're worthless. You're going to embarrass yourself and then respond to it in the first person. I hear you saying that and I don't agree. The act of externalizing the voice, of actually speaking it as a separate entity, breaks the fusion between the voice and the self. Once you've said it out loud, you can hear that it's not you. It's a thing that talks to you.
So the shift is from, I'm worthless, to, you're telling me I'm worthless. And that grammatical shift, from first person to second person, is the whole intervention. It's not a feeling anymore. It's a claim. And claims can be evaluated.
Claims can be evaluated. That's exactly it. And the evaluation is where the counter-evidence accumulation comes in. Because once the voice is reclassified as a claim rather than a truth, you can start testing it against experience. Not once. Repeatedly. The research on belief updating suggests that single instances of counter-evidence are insufficient because the brain needs to build a new predictive model, not just log an exception. So the person who was told they're bad with people needs to accumulate a track record of social successes over and over until the model starts to shift. And even then, it's not a clean break. The old model doesn't disappear. It just loses its default status.
There's a grief component here that I don't think gets talked about enough. When you stop believing you're bad at something, you also lose a piece of your self-narrative. If I was never actually bad at math, what else about my childhood story is wrong? The whole structure starts to wobble, and that's disorienting. It's not just relief. It's grief for the person you thought you were, and for the childhood you thought you had.
That's the identity reconstruction challenge. The Interject isn't just a belief about your abilities. It's a load-bearing wall in the story of your life. The person who was told they were the difficult one has built an entire autobiography around being difficult. If that's not true, then what was actually happening? Who was actually difficult? The parent? The family system? The answers to those questions can be much harder to live with than the original story.
Because the original story, at least, was stable. It explained things. The new story might be more accurate, but it's also more complicated, and it implicates people you were trained to protect.
This is where Daniel's question about the true self gets tricky. Because the temptation is to think, okay, if the Interject is false, then there must be a true self underneath it, a pre-existing, authentic self that was buried and just needs to be uncovered. And I don't think that's quite right. The goal isn't to find a fixed, pre-existing self. It's to develop a reliable self-intuition, a capacity to trust your own assessments of your experience rather than deferring to the internalized voice. The true self isn't something you discover. It's something you construct by testing your own judgments against reality and learning which ones hold up.
It's less archaeology and more engineering. You're not excavating a buried statue. You're building a working model of yourself, and the model gets more accurate the more you use it and calibrate it.
That reframes the acceleration question. What speeds this up? First, naming the voice when it speaks. The metacognitive labeling. When you notice the voice saying, you're going to fail at this, you label it. That's the Interject. That's the old recording. Just naming it creates distance. Second, seeking environments that provide consistent, structured counter-evidence. Not occasional compliments, but sustained exposure to situations where your actual performance contradicts the voice's predictions. Third, building relationships with people who can serve as accurate mirrors. People whose feedback you can trust because they have no investment in your assigned role. They didn't know you as the difficult one. They only know you as the person in front of them.
The accurate mirror point is underrated. Most people's feedback is useless, not because they're dishonest, but because they're reflecting back the same script. The family member who tells you you've always been difficult is just playing the old recording. The colleague who tells you you handled that negotiation brilliantly is giving you new data. You need more of the second kind and less of the first.
There's a species-level dimension here that Daniel gestured at, and I think it's worth taking seriously. When someone believes they're bad at what they're actually good at, their potential contribution is withheld from the collective. It's not just a personal loss. It's a loss to everyone who would have benefited from what that person could have done. The therapist who never became a therapist because they were told they weren't a people person. The writer who never wrote because they were told they had nothing to say. The engineer who never built anything because they were told they weren't technical. The world is poorer for every one of those withholdings.
The introject isn't just a private nuisance. It's a collective problem. Every false negative about a human capability is a subtraction from the human firmament, to use Daniel's phrase.
The thing that makes it so pernicious is that the person carrying the introject often can't see what they're withholding. They think they're making a rational assessment. I'm just not good at that. They don't know that the assessment was made for them decades ago by someone with a vested interest in them believing it.
Let's talk about what the acceleration actually looks like in practice, because I think there's a misconception that this is a slow, grinding process that takes decades, and it can be. But the naming step, the reclassification step, can happen in a single moment. The moment you hear the voice and realize it's not you, that's a before and after. It doesn't fix everything, but it changes the relationship permanently.
The voice therapy literature supports that. The first time a patient articulates the voice out loud and responds to it, something shifts. It's not that the voice goes away, it's that the patient now has a position outside the voice. They're no longer inside it. And from that outside position, the accumulation of counter-evidence can actually do its work. Before the reclassification, the counter-evidence was just noise. After the reclassification, it's data.
The sequence is reclassify first, accumulate second. If you try to accumulate counter-evidence before reclassifying the voice just vetoes everything. You get the fluke effect. But once the voice is reclassified, the same evidence starts to lend differently.
The people who change careers in their 30s or 40s and discover they're excellent at something they were told their whole lives they couldn't do, that's the pattern. The counter-evidence was always there. The aptitude was always there. What changed is that they finally stopped letting the voice veto the data. They took a class, or accepted a project, or just tried the thing, and the evidence accumulated fast because the filter was no longer active.
There's a phrase I keep coming back to. The person you were told you were isn't the person you are, but the person you're is still being written, and you get a vote now. That's the whole thing. The vote was taken away in childhood. The work of self-realization is getting it back.
The father never said anything negative about the ceramics.
Say that again.
The father never said anything negative about the ceramics. I spent 3 years in my 20s working as a professional son. Families would hire me to play the successful child at gatherings, weddings, funerals, business dinners. I'd show up in a suit, call the father dad, talk about my job in finance. The real son would be there too, usually. And the father would introduce me as my son, the investment banker, and then introduce the real son as the one who can't hold a job. I remember one client. The real son was a ceramicist, had been working at the same studio for 8 years. 8 years, same job. But the father introduced him as the one who can't hold a job, and the son had started to believe it. He'd say it himself. I can't hold a job. Meanwhile, he'd been at the same studio for 8 years. The father never once mentioned the ceramics, never criticized them, never praised them, just never mentioned them, like they didn't exist. And I started to think the most damaging parental messages might not be the ones spoken aloud. They're the ones that are conspicuous by their absence. The child learns what the parent doesn't see, doesn't value, doesn't acknowledge. The silence is the message. And in my acting training, they taught us that a character is defined by what other characters say about them. I've never been able to shake the feeling that we're all, to some degree, being written by people who never read the source material.
The silence point is the one I want to hold on to. Because we've been talking about the voice that says you're bad at this, but the voice of omission might be even harder to expel because it never made a claim you can refute. It just created an absence, a blank space where the acknowledgement should have been. And the child fills that blank space with the worst possible interpretation.
The father never said the ceramics were worthless. He just never looked at them. And the son concluded they must not be worth looking at. That's not even an introject. That's a vacuum that the child filled with a negative self-assessment, because a negative self-assessment is easier to live with than the truth, which is that the father was incapable of seeing him.
The 8 years at the same studio is the detail that kills me. The evidence was right there. The man had held a job for 8 years. The father's story was that he couldn't hold a job. The facts contradicted the story completely. But the story was the family narrative, and the family narrative had more authority than the facts.
Because the narrative was installed before the facts existed. By the time the son had held the job for 8 years, the story was already 2 decades old. The story had seniority.
The father paid me well. I never asked what the real son thought of the arrangement. I didn't want to know.
That's the thing about the assigned role. The person who's been cast as the one who can't hold a job will keep playing the part, even when they're not playing it. The ceramicist, who's held the same job for 8 years, still introduces himself as the one who can't hold a job. The role has become the identity. The facts are just scenery.
The professional son, the actor, was more real to the father than the actual son, because the actor was playing the role the father had written. The actual son was off script.
He was, and the script was the only thing the father could see.
That observation about omission, about what parents don't say, is worth sitting with, because it expands the whole conversation. We've been talking about the voice that tells you you're bad at something, but there's also the voice that never says anything at all, and the silence is just as formative. The child learns what the parent values by what the parent notices, and what the parent doesn't notice, the child learns to devalue in themselves.
That connects to the accurate mirror point. The person who can serve as an accurate mirror is the person who actually sees you, not the person who sees the role you were assigned. The ceramicist's father never saw the ceramics. The accurate mirror would be someone who looked at the ceramics and said, "These are good," not because they were being nice, but because they actually looked.
The work of self-realization, in the end, is partly about finding people who will actually look, and partly about learning to look at yourself, without the filter of the assigned role. Both of those are skills. Both of them can be practiced.
The acceleration question, Daniel's core question. I think the answer is yes, it can be accelerated, but not through force. Not through willpower, not through affirmations, not through just deciding to believe something different. It accelerates through reclassification. Naming the voice as a voice, not a truth. Then accumulating counter-evidence in environments where the evidence can actually land. Then building relationships with people who see you accurately. The sequence matters. Reclassify, accumulate, mirror. In that order.
The grief is part of it. The disorientation when the old story starts to crumble. That's not a sign that something's wrong. It's a sign that the renovation is actually happening. The old walls are coming down.
The question I keep turning over is what authenticity means if the true self is something we construct rather than discover. If the interject is a foreign process, and the reliable self-intuition is something we build, then what does it mean to be authentic? Is authenticity just the quality of the construction? Is an authentic self one that you built deliberately rather than one that was built for you?
Maybe authenticity isn't about finding the original blueprint. Maybe it's about being the one who signs off on the final design. The person who was told they were bad at math, and then became good at math, and then had to decide whether they actually liked math, or were just proving something. That's the authentic moment. The decision.
The decision. That's the vote. And the vote is the thing that was taken away in childhood, and the thing that self-realization gives back. A franchise.
Daniel's question was whether this can be accelerated. I think the answer is yes, but the acceleration doesn't come from trying harder. It comes from reclassifying the voice, accumulating counter-evidence in environments where it can land, and building relationships with people who see you accurately. The voice may never fully go silent, but it can be demoted from truth to artifact. And that demotion is the beginning of everything else.
The person you were told you were isn't the person you are, but the person you're is still being written, and you get a vote now.
Thanks to our producer, Hubert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts.
If you want to reach us, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go, from sloth slow takes to facts on cue. We chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.